Please help me welcome our speaker tonight. Our speaker is Norm from the Frenarios Group in Westchester, Pennsylvania.
Hey, I'm Norm and I'm an alcoholic. And I'm really, really proud to say that tonight. I really am. My life is great in Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm here to kind of just to say I'm just kind of in awe, just how the vibe, the energy of a group, just to watch like a pocket of enthusiasm, just absolutely of a lot of people just starting to love their life. I don't know. I mean, that's when I came into Alcoholics Anonymous, I definitely didn't see that. I didn't feel that. I didn't know that was even here. You know, I'm going to say the only thing that I'm probably going to really think about saying tonight, I'm an alcoholic and I have a sobriety date. It's June 15th, 2006. I have a sponsor. He has a sponsor. Both have been through the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. I have a home group. It's the Frenarios group. It's in Westchester on Tuesday nights at 8:30. It is a smoking meeting, and it's not like this, and it's probably maybe a quarter of the size of this room, so you better wear a smoking vest or whatever you want to do. I don't smoke, but I still go, and there's a lot of newcomers, and there's a lot of people there who save my butt on a daily basis. But I'll tell you what, my life is great. Like I said before, I think, you know, tonight what I'm going to try to do is give my experience and what it was like before I came in here. You know, what happened to me that got me to where I'm at today, and what it is like today. And, you know, right now I'm going to start off with what it's like today, because I think that's the biggest thing that gets shortchanged in my experience. You know, I mean, I'll go and I'll listen to someone share, and it's about 40 minutes of a drunk log sometimes, and then they hear just, oh yeah, 5 minutes, yeah, it's really, really good today, and here's kind of the short, summarized version of what I do. Today, I'll tell you what, my day was actually very, very horrible. Everything I had on my work laptop for the past 4 years got deleted. I lost access to pretty much every technology piece that I had there, and I'll tell you what, the old me was probably just absolutely go and try to batter the guy who did it, but I'll tell you what, I looked at it and I just said, you know what, I'm probably just not meant to have those files right now. I'm probably not meant to do that. And I'll tell you what, you know, God works in my life in so many different ways. God is that little voice inside of me that tells me what things are right and wrong. It's that feeling of pain when I'm doing the wrong thing. It's that voice inside my head today that says, you should probably do something like this because this feels right. I'll tell you what I did right before I took it to this guy to have him upload some new software. I backed everything up. You know, so when he did that, you know, I don't know why I thought like that. I don't even question that stuff anymore. I don't question what happens in my life. Why is that mental 2x4 that I just beat myself over the head with? I just know that God is there, and I know that He works in my life on a daily basis. So much as I choose to see Him. My life is great today because I know the solution. How I feel today is the direct result of the actions that I take, and it is my connection with a higher power. I like to call mine God just because if I have to say higher power 3 times fast, it's just not going to work. I say God because it's just very simple for me, which is pretty much how the program is. My program is I wake up in the morning, you know, I'm ready for the adventure. I have an idea what's going to happen, but I have no clue what are the little details that are going to fill in that day. And, you know, when you go and you become open to everything that God, you know, unlocks for you, It really is an amazing journey. And, you know, none of that would have been possible if I had not wandered in here absolutely broken, smelling, looking horrible, as I did, into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, to where somebody looked at me who had it paid forward for him and helped me pay it forward, and God had it paid forward to me. And he looked at me like the poor, sorry SOB that I really was, and he goes, it doesn't have to be like that anymore. You, right now, stand at that turning point. You can choose to go down that same path you've always gone down before, that you've gone down 1,000 times. You know, my problem wasn't that I couldn't stop. I could stop any time I wanted to. It was I couldn't consistently stop. I couldn't, like, put it down and then never do it again. And when he goes there, he took my hand and put my hand in the hand of something I didn't understand, I didn't necessarily believe in, I didn't trust it. And you know what? My life got better. And he just said, you know, these 12 simple steps, there's merely suggestion. You can do them if you want, but I'm just going to tell you, what you put into it is exactly what you're going to get out. You know, you reap what you sow. He goes, I'm going to plant the seed, and I'm going to try to water it as much as I possibly can. And some days, I'm going to be able to watch that seed grow. And, you know, that's not for me to decide. You know, I grew up around Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. I'm a son of an alcoholic. You go figure. Growing up, you know, more is always better. I could always work more hours. I woke up at like 6 in the morning. I worked on a farm. It's a hard life. You know, I never really saw my father, never saw all that kind of stuff, but I was raised right. You know, I knew right from wrong. I had a family that really did love me. Yeah, we all had problems. We were kind of the mafia of a small little 1,000-person town. And like, you know, when you're a designated driver at the age of 8 and a police officer comes over to you and he goes, oh, I'm sorry, Mr. Shelley. Let me drive you home, you know, because my dad's passed out in the seat next to me. You know, that's the type of stuff that, you know, kind of gets you like, yeah, I really am truly better than these people. This is great. And you know, I took a guy through a fifth step yesterday, and I was reading, like, you know, the fourth step there, and it was saying, you know, sometimes we're just egomaniacs with inferiority complex. I don't know if that's necessarily in the book, but I remember it said when we got cocky, it got way worse. And for me, I masked every bit of fear, every bit of self-loathing with absolute arrogance and cockiness. And when I did that, I just dug myself a lot deeper. You know, that to me is as progressive as you know, putting booze into my body. You know, I had so many more maladies than just drinking. You know, when I came in here, putting the drink down, my problems didn't stop. My problems got so much worse. So he took away my freaking solution. I'll tell you what, alcohol saved my life. And I'll tell you how. There were plenty of times I probably would have blown my brains out if booze was not there for me. I would have absolutely drove myself nuts. But I'll tell you what, that was a temporary solution to a permanent problem. You know, I was a permanent problem. Ever since I was growing up, my alcoholism didn't just happen when I put that booze in there. I'd always look for something that's going to fill me up. I'd always look for something that's going to just fill Norm up permanently or make him feel like he's actually worth something. Or he's up to the level that you people really are, even though in my mind I know I'm better than you. And to me is absolutely insanity. It's just insane thinking. I remember the first time I drank a beer, I went fetched a beer for the Dallas Cowboys New York Giants game at my dad's friend's house. I was probably about 4 years old, and I remember drinking that old Milwaukee and thinking about, yeah, I'm drinking with the big boys. And of course, you know, I got it easily taken away from me and said, don't do that. But I remember growing up, you know, shortly after that, I remember what it tastes like. I didn't know the facts, and I didn't understand it. I saw what it did for my dad. I saw that he was a lot happier and really wanted to be around me and wanted to spend some time. I didn't think it was horrible, you know, and then I was introduced to the wonderful DARE program, and I found out that anybody who drinks or smokes or does anything like that are evil. You are all evil, evil people. And I remember the first time I saw my mother drink her first beer. And I looked at her and I said, oh my God, you're horrible. You're a horrible person. And I didn't understand that you can, you know, that people do that. I didn't understand what alcohol was. But all I knew is that, you know, what my role in the situation was to drive, you know, when I needed to, you know, between farms when he would, you know, when my dad was drunk. And, I don't know, a lot of different things. So I remember one night that I was there, driving home, crashing, which we usually did. We crashed numerous times. And I just remember remembering it the next morning. It was a little bit different because I'd never seen somebody like that. I didn't understand the relief that he was going through. I didn't understand the absolute pure relief that he felt when he was blackout drunk. I was told that it was just a mental or nervous breakdown, and that's just what happened. So, of course, instead of holding all my emotion in, I always like to let it out. And, you know, I told you exactly what I thought, no matter how honest it was or what. For me, about this time, you know, things usually hit the wall for alcoholics like us. It gets progressively worse if you don't stop. I mean, an alcoholic without a solution in his life is going to drink again. And to drink, it's going to get worse, probably die, or go to jail, or be in an institution. I don't know, all the other wonderful fates that are tied to this disease. So we moved out, and I lived out of a car for about 6 months with my parent, or with my mom. And it was a school teacher, and I had two other sisters who were both younger than me. And I was in middle school at the time, so I remember coming in, and we didn't really have a whole lot, but I didn't really seem to care, just because I was kind of oblivious and naive to the whole situation, you know. And this is the first time I started noticing girls. I started looking around. I started feeling really self-conscious that, you know, I'm the kid with the skin-tight sweatpants with a rip in the back, and I'm looking at all you people wearing your JNCO jeans and your wonderful, like, you know, your really hip clothes, and I felt really inadequate. And that fear has pretty much stuck with me up until I really got good with God in this program, probably about maybe a year and a half ago, when I had another spiritual awakening, and a lot of that fear just kind of lifted. Now we'll fast forward to, I was a good kid. I was great in school. I loved learning. Learning is huge, and it's tied to my sobriety, my spirituality, big time. When I read, I strengthen my mind. That mental part is just one of the three parts of my program. It's the spiritual, the physical, and the mental. And, you know, I put knowledge up to as one of my most cherished things. And I got into a great school at the University of Delaware. I went down there and found people who did what I wanted to do. Now, I found out, you know, before that, like, I was the type of guy who was really unlucky when he drank. When I drank, I always got caught. I remember the 4th of July, I, you know, reached my hand up underneath the porch, you know, from my room, my bedroom down there, and I, you know, would steal the beer out of the... Of course, I'd go probably 2 or 3 days later, and I would be drinking by myself, of course, and try to recycle, and of course... My mom would either pull up, or somebody would see me and report me back to my mom, or all this stuff. So, you know, I was pretty straight edge until I got to college. And then I saw Animal House, and I know how you're supposed to react in college. I knew that if your keg's not flying through your window, if you're not crazy, and if you're not living it up, and I can't grow long hair, so I'll probably just drink like I'm nuts. And I found people who did exactly what I did, because that's all I looked for. And I'll tell you what, man, I loved it. Every second of it, I became the person I really wanted to be. I didn't really know who that was, since before that, I was always a chameleon. Even to this day, I can still be a chameleon just like that. I was a jock, I was a brain, I was a hippie, I was a musician, I was a mod, I was everything. You know, I was anything you wanted me to be. I had no clue who I was, because I was afraid to be who I really was. And I was afraid to find that out, but it was so much easier being somebody else. Or what somebody else wanted me to be. So going down there, I just finally branched out to be an idea that I thought other people wanted to see. So I went down, and the first time I just drank, and I felt, man, this is college, and I've arrived. And I didn't immediately say, oh, I want to have this every day of my life, and this is the best thing that's ever happened to me. No. I mean, for a long time, man, I lived in delusion. I lived in such a delusional world that I'm not like my father. I'm not like any of you smelly, nasty drunks. I'm not under a bridge. I'm going to be somebody. I'm going to be going to school. I'm going to make more money than God. You know, I'm going to be something. And I remember drinking hard liquor for the first time. And when I did that, and I don't say this to brag at all, I took 17 shots in about 45 minutes. And the reason I did that is because when I drank a beer, I felt it a little bit. I felt the effect. When I drank liquor, I felt the effect a little bit, but not a whole lot at that time. So what do? You just keep drinking. You break the top off the bottle and you keep pouring them. And if they're kamikazes, that means you're hardcore or whatever. So that's what I thought. And I woke up the next day, because when I drink and I black out, I turn into a track star. I run. I do backflips. I do whatever I could possibly do. And now, sober, I can't even do backflips. So I don't know how that happens. But I remember waking up the next day, and I had a big scar down my face, because when I go out and I run, I face plant. And I remember hearing people for the first time, dude, do you remember what you did? And I said, yeah, well, we had a couple of drinks and I went to bed, right? I said, dude, you went nuts. You are running down the hall, kicking everybody's door, starting to fight with people you don't even know. And you tried like punching us, but you were too damn drunk and you fell down. And I was like, I did that. I that's not me. That's not what I do. I'm a fun-loving guy. Yeah, that's what I am. And you know, that pretty much for me, when you put booze into an alcoholic like me, you may get violent, Norm. You may get happy, Norm. You may get calm, Norm. You may get Very, very depressed, Norm. I don't know. Towards the end of my drinking, I could map it out pretty well for you. Very social, very happy, very genial, very afraid, very paranoid, and then I'm in the corner crying or trying to slit your throat. That's me. And I could never count what I did. The more I tried to control it, the more I got more restless here and more discontent until I got really what I wanted. You know, if you put booze in front of me and you told me to control yourself, I couldn't do it. I wouldn't drink. Now for me, I love my education. I drank probably Monday through Friday, or I drank only Saturdays first, and then it was Fridays and Saturdays, and then it was Thursdays, Fridays, and Saturdays. But if I had something maybe the next week, like a test, I knew I'd have to leave at least 3 days of recuperation time, because, you know, of course you're hungover and you can't move, and you usually order Chinese off a couch the next day. And then, of course, you're still foggy and you can't do anything. For me, it took about a solid week after drinking to really get back up. So my option was just don't do it at all. And I did great in school. I looked awesome on paper. But, you know, slowly but surely, I started just feeling a little bit dead inside. You know, I didn't realize that alcohol was slowly starting to creep in and become my solution to all my problems that I had. My first big price is I worked at a freight dock that summer, and one of my roommates came up, and I didn't really drink when I was at home. There's nobody to really drink with. Just, I'm a social alcoholic. That's what I do. I don't drink when no one's there. You know, I mean, that's how I justified everything in my head. But when my roommate came up, I said, okay, well, maybe this once. And I drove blackout drunk to a freight dock, and that's, I woke up the next morning and didn't have a job. But that's how you play the game, and that's the consequence, and I can easily lie and manipulate to get myself out of that situation. That's exactly what I did. And I went back to school, and, you know, I continued to do what I wanted to do. I continued to start to pay prices. I continued to have a lot of people around who didn't really want me to be around, but I didn't need them. I gravitated towards people who drank exactly like I did, who had what I wanted. And they were the people who were the people you probably don't like at a party, who go and pick fights, who go and steal. We used to have stealing parties. We used to go and see, you know, and assess points for what we could get out of a house. And that's just what I do. I mean, that's what an alcoholic like me does. And you know what? The whole concept of God or being spiritually bankrupt never really came in my mind as being my problem. In that whole time, I just thought, man, all these problems are just, you know, I don't know. I'm just pretty unlucky. And maybe it may be the booze. And I may be different than a lot of these guys. But never once, I kept hearing people saying, you got to get, you know, spiritual out. You have to do this. And, you know, I just said, oh, thanks, but no thanks. I don't need this. And, you know, I became part of a wonderful club, that ARD. And some of you who know what I'm talking about know that ARD is a wonderful little program that makes you jump through a lot of hoops. But when I got that DUI, it was in my hometown that we had been like the little mafia. And I was taking an underage girl who was my friend's girlfriend to go get cigarettes. And she had leukemia, and I thought that was okay to do. And I was drunk, and I remember getting pulled over and stopped and eventually put in the back of the cop car. And when I'm doing that, I'm thinking, you don't know who I am. Do you know that, like, 10 years ago I was pretty big, and do you know that I'm, like, who I'm going to be? He said, yeah, I don't care. They went and they took me, and they got blood alcohol tests, and there you go. My first real thing that I really had to put up on the wall was, man, something that was really a major inconvenience to my drinking. I went and I got the CRD, whatever, you know, I mean, people, if you know what it is, it's an evaluation from a state worker who tells you, yeah, you need this level of treatment. Person saw right through my BS. For the first time, someone was really, truly honest with me. Now, I say that because that's how I am with anybody who comes and asks for my suggestion. You know, I was always told, you know, I'd rather walk on your pride than walk on your grave. And I truly believe that because someone had the honesty to make, you know, to be honest to me for the first time in my life. And she recommended the highest level of treatment. And, you know, and I remember I said, that's just BS. And I went and circumvented the thing and went to another state worker. And she recommended me the lowest level of treatment. And that's just how an alcoholic like me gets around it. You know, lo and behold, I on paper, again, I look good. I'm a double major, triple minor. I'm magna cum laude. I'm president of organizations, and things look pretty darn good. You know, I get busted for an underage drinking thing about a month before my birthday. And it was at a charity event that I helped sponsor and I gave the opening keynote speech for. It was for Relay for Life. And during the beginning, and that was at night that we started it, and during that day it was a Chapel Festival, which is an all-day drinking event that's on Chapel Street. And I got so blasted, but it wasn't good enough. So what I did was I filled my backpack full of 30-pack and a bottle of Evan Williams, and I said, let's go. Let's walk against cancer. So I go there and I go up there and I say some BS speech of, yeah, we're all here for a good cause, and that's just who I can be anybody for like a split second. You know, but then, you know, of course I was hauled out of there and they at least let me finish my speech before they brought me in and handcuffed me and took me away again. That was something now that, you know, it says our problems will just, you know, mount upon each other. You know, it'd be insurmountable. And now I'm on probation in two different states and the University of Delaware. And now you start holding something that I really like. I like my education. I thought of who I was going to be. And I'm afraid. And I go and see that one guy who I know who's kind of got it out, who I trust. It was my father. And now he has about 8 years of sobriety. And I go up to the guy and I say, Dad, I'm scared. There's something wrong with me. This doesn't happen. He goes, you know, I'm not going to tell you if you are or you're not an alcoholic. What I can tell you, though, is that people who've been exactly where you're at and have done what you've done usually don't come out alive. He goes, I'm not saying you are or you're not, but what I can tell you is that there's a place to go to find out if you are. Go to a couple meetings, get a little bit of information, and when you're armed with the facts, then you can make an apt decision. That sounds logical, sounds reasonable. So I was the last person in the meeting. The one meeting I went to a week, I was the last person in the meeting. Didn't say a damn thing to anybody because I had nothing that you people wanted. Couldn't identify because my experience with booze was different. Because I couldn't understand or relate to the happiness that you had. I couldn't relate because people would always trust me. And the lady who was speaking that night talked about for the first time people trust her. Not my thing. I left early, didn't talk to anybody. And like I said before, you know, most people who don't have a solution in their life usually go out and commit another action. And that's exactly what I did my birthday, June 13, 2006. I went out. I don't remember a damn thing. I woke up in a fire lane. Actually, I woke up in a hospital. They found me in a fire lane. Woke up with IVs in me, and I had a nurse over top of me. And I'm like, oh, God, where the hell am I? That wasn't the first thought that I thought. The first thought was, why didn't I die? And about a month earlier, I tried so many times to. I was such a pansy. I couldn't do it myself. But I just. I got on my knees and I prayed to something I didn't really understand. But I always blamed for all my problems. And I said, I don't care what the hell you do. Just make me whole or kill me. Do it now. I'm tired of waiting. I hate everybody. I hate you. I hate myself most of all. And I want to see everybody around me just die. And when I came into the program at Alcoholics Anonymous, they said, go and find somebody who has something that you want. I'm homicidal and suicidal. I don't know really if I want to find that guy who has what I want. But I remember that. And I remember that day waking up in there and just saying, God, I didn't die. You screwed it up again, God. And I said, you know, and I've been in enough places and I don't care. And I'm still really, really drunk. And I remember ripping out those IVs as soon as she said, yeah, you're really lucky. I said, no, I'm not. And I rip them out, and I try running out of the hospital, and I trip over every freaking wire that they have there into every machine, fall into a corner, and in all my glory, I pee myself. And you know, I'm sitting there covered in blood and piss, and I'm thinking to myself, wow, this is where Norm Shelley's going to be the rest of his life. Either that or I'm going to die. This is really it. I'm going to do this until I die or until I'm incarcerated. I'm already halfway there with probation in two different states, and I'm not sure if they're talking, and I haven't eaten in about a week because I'm so damn nervous if they are. And all these little minor problems. And I remember going that, you know, sleeping in the whole rest of the day and going to work the next, and on that Thursday, and my mother coming down to take me out for my dinner. She drove 2 hours down from Harrisburg, a lady of Al-Anon who knows how to deal with people like us, you know, knows how to save her own skin and be her own individual person because she knows she doesn't have power to get somebody else sober. And she goes, you know, we'll take you out. And I find out that I'm getting kicked out of the University of Delaware pending a court trial, which is, you know, usually a run-of-the-mill type of thing where they just, you know, the dog and pony show where they just tell you you're out and there's nothing you can really do. And she goes, yeah, I know. I knew this was happening. And I said, dude, did you get the email too? She goes, no, you're a drunk. That's what you do. So I'll still take you out, though. So she goes and she takes me to Westminster House. Tells me to get the hell out of the car and that I'll get a ride home because these are good people. And she drives 2 hours back to Harrisburg. And that was my introduction, my real introduction to Alcoholics Anonymous. I walk into that room and some heavyset guy's putting some books down on the tables and on the chairs. And he comes over and he's so happy and he comes over and he goes, "Hey man, how you doing?" I said, "Man, I am so good right now. I'm good. He goes, "No, really. How are you doing?" And he looked me right in the eye, and I looked at this man in the eye, and I come, you know, from a pretty rustic area. You don't cry in front of people, especially not men. You're a man. You know, Clint Eastwood, the Duke, that's it. And I broke down and I cried, and I told this man my whole life story just in a matter of 15 minutes of how my life, blow by blow, had absolutely fallen into ruin and chaos as a result of my drinking, and how this is just one big nightmare that won't ever go away, and I don't think there's any hope and there's ever anything like that. And I'm hysterical, and I smell horrible, and I look horrible. And this man comes up, and he just smiles. He goes, "Man, I'm so glad you're here. Go with this guy, because we're about ready to start the meeting, but I want you to stay here, because I have a bunch of people you should talk to, and I can't wait to talk to you until after the meeting." I go out, and this guy, who I don't really know, you know, takes me by the hand, and sits me down out in the foyer, and then starts talking to me about a solution and a God I don't understand. I said, "Okay, I mean, religious zealot. People are nuts. I mean, you people are absolutely crazy talking about God is going to relieve you from pain and misery and whatever. I don't understand. I just got to stop drinking. That's my problem. I just got to stop." And when he goes out there and he's telling me this thing, he kept me there for an hour. He kept me mesmerized with just how good my life could be. He mentioned God. He mentioned the thing of God. But he talks about his life and how carefree and how free he was able to be. How the bonds and shackles of Alcoholics Anonymous, the bonds and shackles of alcohol were totally removed from him. He goes and he talks about this wonderful, beyond my wildest dreams. This thing that I don't have to ever feel the way I felt ever again. And I'm there, and it kept me there. And then after that meeting, I was surrounded, like many people do, to newcomers. And sometimes I feel bad for newcomers, because when you say you're a newcomer and a meeting full of active members of Alcoholics Anonymous, they will swarm on you. They will come and circle around, and they will give you a big book, and everyone's trying to show you what they have. And I tell you what, I was just like, "Jesus Christ, what is in the coffee here?" You know, I said, "There is no possible way that this is happening. You guys have to at least drink one day a week or do something. I mean, you're doing blow in the corner. I don't know what you're doing." And the biggest thing and one thing I remember the most is that guys came up to me and said, "Dude, you don't know how lucky you are. You don't know that your life from this day forward could possibly change into something that you can't even comprehend right now." He goes, "You don't know what your purpose is in this world, but I'll tell you what, man, you're saving my butt right now, but I am so glad you were here." I said, "Here's my number, here's a list of numbers, please call us. Please, do me a favor and call us." It didn't take long for me to give these guys a call, because, you know, a guy without a solution like me is going absolutely batshit crazy. I'm going off the wall. I know that, you know, I keep hearing going to meetings. Go to meetings. Don't drink between meetings. Go and do that. First step. Now, for a guy like me, I have lost the freaking power of choice. I can't not drink in between meetings. You know, I'll go to a meeting, and then once that hour is over and once the fellowship leaves, I am alone again. I'm scared. I don't know what I'm going to do, but I'll tell you what, that obsession to drink has come absolutely back up, and I'm nuts. I have no mental defense against that first drink. The only thing I can do is kind of wall myself up. And for me, at that time, I'm living in a house with four other active alcoholics who are college guys who have no idea of what my problem or malady actually truly is. And I remember going and finding the guy who was so damn angry, but he didn't drink, and that's exactly what I wanted to be. And I still hated every one of you people. I hated people who were happy the most, because they were rubbing it in every day. Every day I went by, they were rubbing it into me. And I found this guy, and I had him for probably about maybe 2 weeks until it was about the 4th of July, and we were riding bicycles, and someone came too close to him and his daughter in the car, and I guess he went over and started a fight with the whole family and kicked the door in. And at that time, I realized that that's probably not what Alcoholics Anonymous is like. Because by that time, I'd seen people come in who had actually been happy, consistently happy, and not tell me to shut the hell up when I had a question asked, and they told me to go out there and get active. Not, you know, I mean, I was told by this guy that the second step was you're walking down the street and some birds fluttering, shit, there's God. I had no freaking idea what the hell he was talking about. You know, when I finally got into my first step, it was pretty much summed up in I'm screwed. Two words, I'm screwed. I'm done. How much more life has my life become unmanageable? You know, I'm in probation in two different states and getting kicked out. You know, I can't stop drinking no matter what I do. Change the location. You know, people are like, you know, places. I should change location. I'm like, yeah, that sounds like a great idea. And you know what? It sounds like a great idea until someone put it to me this way. If you had cancer, you wouldn't just move to Kansas. Kansas is not going to cure my cancer unless there's a clinic out there that can. You know, unless you have an active solution. So I'm like, okay, so that probably doesn't work because I've moved plenty of times. I've moved probably about 18 times in my life and I've still been this guy. You know, so I go and I ask this guy, all right, so what do we do here? And pretty much, I must have been wet brain because he took me through the first three steps before I even knew I went through the first three steps. You know, he went and he asked me if I was willing to believe in a power greater than myself that would restore me to sanity. I said, yeah, I am. Because I believe that I'm not dead yet. I believe that too many things in my life have been coincidence for it to absolutely happen by accident. He goes, that's good. He's like, and if you believe that I believe, that'll do for right now. I said, all right. He's like, moving on to step three. I said, whoa, geez, no, that's like year two. That's what I got to do. And for me, I don't know if it's your experience or not, but I have a progressive disease. I need a progressive solution. I'm going, if I have a disease is going to kill the host. It's a parasite. It's going to eventually kill the host that it's in. And for me, you know, I need to go and seek the solution as fast as I possibly can because I'm dying. I am dying. And he goes, no, we're moving on to step three. He goes, you show me in there where it shows me, where it tells you a timetable. He goes, do you understand? Are you willing to believe? I said, absolutely. He said, we're moving on. Though your conception of God at this time is limited, it will do. He goes, God will reveal himself to you in the rest of the 12 steps. I said, all right. I'm going out on a limb. And he goes, are you willing? You know, I made a decision to turn my will and my life under the care of God as I understood him. Man. And for me, I thought that was, well, my car broke down. God didn't put gas in the car. That's just it. He goes, no, you are a freaking idiot. He goes, you know, when you make a decision to turn your will and your life over to care of God, you're turning everything over to this guy. You are making yourself readily available to be of service to this higher power. Doesn't mean that you stop doing action. It means you do more action. Because you become aware now of the things that you need to do. You become available. He goes, what I want you to do now is, you know, do the rest of the steps. That's your decision. You know, he said, decision has to be followed up by action or it means absolutely nothing. He gave me directions for my fourth step and I wrote my fourth step. That was the biggest thing. And since that day, when I did that fifth step with that man, I had not had an obsession to drink since that day. I thought about alcohol. Of course I did. Alcohol was a great time. I'd be lying to you to say my, you know, whatever the saying is, my best day drunk was better or worse than my worst day sober. No, I had a blast when I was out there. I wouldn't have done it so long. And I still continue to think about it because that's kind of what I do. Because I reminisce of what the solution was actually like for me. But, you know, since that day, I have not had the craving. I had not had the obsession. Even in my worst time in sobriety, my darkest days. And I'll be here to tell you, I'm not perfect. And about a year and a half in sobriety, I tried to kill myself. And I'll tell you why. I didn't have that connection with God anymore. I didn't seek God. I didn't look for God. My God had absolutely been replaced with material things. People and things of this world. And you know what I tell my sponsees is, say, I'm going to fail you in three different ways. I'm either going to move away, I'm going to die, or I'm going to get drunk. Your reliance is not upon me. It's upon dependence on a higher power. And if you don't have that, then God help you. I don't know. That works for me. Because my solution is portable. My solution, I can go anywhere in this world as long as I'm on good terms with God. And I'll tell you what. I mean, for people who, you know, who I've done what they've done and people who do what I do, they've gotten the same kind of solution. And I'm not saying that it's just been my take on it. And there's plenty of different ways you can interpret things and look at it. I went and I did it right out of the book, the way I was instructed by my sponsor. And when I went, and the book is merely guidelines on how to live my life today. And I went, I did that fifth step, and I couldn't wait because I thought it was free therapy. He told me to write down my resentments, my fears, and my sexual conduct. And boy, was I just ready to dump on how everybody had screwed me. And how all the fears, I'm not really a fearful person, but, you know, I guess if I had to say something, it was this. And then sexual conduct, I had to say about how all the women had screwed me over and how I was still like a real player. And, you know, I mean, have you ever got that God shot, that absolute slap in the face, that left hook that you really weren't expecting? Because I remember sitting outside of the church at my home group, and not going in the home group, but doing that fifth step there. And when he said, Norm, they don't meet the expectations that you set for another person to hit, I was like, oh, really? Really? He goes, Norm, don't you see how self-centered that is? How selfish that is? How much in control you've done? And he goes, look at your problems. What's the common denominator in all your problems? And when I thought about that, I was like, holy crap. I had never looked at my role in any of the situations. I had never examined anything that I've ever done in, you know, and anything, no matter how messed up they were, no matter how many resentments. I'll give you an example, and I don't say it because I'm a victim. I was sexually abused 3 different times by 3 different people. And you know what? I held that as such a resentment. I held it. Man, that was my ace in the hole to go and throw that out when somebody was saying, yeah, my life sucks. I'm like, oh yeah, bam. You know, that's what it was. And I disclose that today because if there's anybody out there, I like to be helpful to you. And I say, you know, you can do that. I'm no longer a victim. For me to be a victim is being selfish, holding something in there, trying to manipulate into something that I'm really not. You know, and I would go on there, my fears, I really realized how much my fear dominated my life. An example, my ninth grade year, I played baseball. I quit baseball because I was so afraid that I was going to strike out in front of other people and I was going to be a failure. I was so afraid what you would think. I could walk into a room and everybody's thinking about me. And I was alone. I could be around 99 friends and feel absolutely alone. Even in sobriety when I first came in here, even about a year and a half into it sometimes, I still had that fear creep up. I could walk in around people who absolutely love me, you know, for nothing and just absolutely feel totally alone and fearful. And I never really understood the sexual conduct part in a fifth step until I really had the experience of experiencing it in sobriety. You know, I understand now what they talk about when you craft your own sexual idea of who you want to be, of who you desire to be with on a mate. You know, if you're traveling down that highway of life, who you want to accompany and grow spiritually towards a higher power with. I understand that today, and it took a lot of lumps, and it almost took me getting killed for me to really understand that. About a year into sobriety, you know, I spoke at my home group, South College Speakers Group down in Newark, Delaware, and I had the girl. I graduated from school because I got back in through the grace of God. I got a job, and I was going to be, and I had everything I ever wanted. Everything I ever wanted. And I'll tell you what, there's no room for God in there when I put my reliance upon everything like that. And I did, and I'll tell you what, the girl left, the job sucked, and eventually, you know, going after school, I didn't have a place that I could sleep until noon. You know, so life changed. And I'll tell you what, when the girl left, my God left. You know, I became incredibly dependent. And it took me about, you know, I had a spiritual awakening in this program by seeking God in so many different areas of my life. You know, I sought God in any possible way I could. I became pretty much what Jim Carrey was in that movie, Yes Man. Someone asked me to come along to a meeting. I said, absolutely. You know, because I had been there, and I understood what it was like to absolutely be crazy and not even put a drink in your body and be powerless and not have a God. Because my conception of God at that time, you know, was that still small God that I had back at step 2 all the way back when I was probably about a month and a half sober. My God, as my view of the world grew, my God didn't grow with it. And if it's not bigger than me, then I'm screwed. And I don't know about you, but I found God. I went and I crawled on my knees back towards God. God had never left, though. God had just moved to a different area. And, you know, I went and I started to experience life. I had my spiritual awakening on an R5 SEPTA train heading into Philadelphia. I was listening to Quadrophenia by The Who because it really symbolized me being pretty much a schizophrenic, you know, having all these different personalities, trying to figure out who the hell I am. Because for the first time in my life, when the girl left, She didn't tell me, you know, she didn't leave me with directions on who I should be. Because I was exactly who she wanted at that time. And I'll tell you what, going and doing an experience in life and having my feet move when my head couldn't move allowed me to go and find that God. I remember listening to that and having, at the end of that album, all four voices and all four personalities come and meld into one. And at the same time, I'm reading Siddhartha and I'm reading the part where his son leaves him and he knows that there's absolutely nothing he can do except for complete spiritual nirvana. And he knows that he has absolutely no control over anything else. And I remember walking off that train and pretty much floating and feeling the touch of God for the second time in my life. After I had done 12 steps, I had my first spiritual awakening. Well, this one was powerful. And from that day, you know, I realized that everything that I had done to get sober the first time is definitely going to work. You know, it's like Novocaine. You give it time, it'll definitely work. You know, keep going at it. You know, keep moving your feet. The same thing that was said 3 months sober still applies today. It was so amazing just how stubborn I was to feel that I could probably find a different way after the solution had worked so well for me. What I did is I went and I did a thorough house cleaning. I went 2 years without seeking anybody else out but of what I could give to another person. I realized what truly a relationship was through reading about what relationships were, asking other people how they did it, but more so consulting God and what felt right. When I went out with somebody, what felt right. I no longer tried to use people for what I could get. I came into a relationship with somebody, whether it be man or woman, you know, and what I could give to that relationship. The same way I came in and tried to see what I can give to a meeting instead of taking. I've taken all my life. I've taken everything from everybody. I would rob you blind if you gave me the opportunity to. And I remember, for me, my motives were incredibly indecent. You could see that in my A step when I first did it. You know, when I wrote down every girlfriend I had, I was so glad a sponsor was there to direct my thinking in a different area. Said, nobody, they're going to be living amends. Because I was so ready to go and try to see what I could work out. Just show you how much I could change. I mean, I'm a spiritually sick person. I'm by no means like completely well or anything like that. I'm continuing to learn. That's the journey for me today. The journey is where God's going to show me to go. I'll tell you what, this is a blast. This is a lot better than knowing what the solution is. When I put a permanence on an impermanent thing, I become unhappy. When I go with the flow and I allow God to dictate the pace, I am really freaking happy. Like in my life, beyond my wildest dreams is an understatement. I just got back probably about a month ago from Egypt. You know, I didn't do anything to really get signed up in that other than just be at the right place at the right time, and I was afforded that. I'm not an archaeologist, but I did archaeology. I had a history minor, that's about it. I knew somebody, and I went over there and I did it. Beyond my wildest dreams, to get right with me, I went and dedicated one time a year to go out by myself and struggle. I went out to Los Angeles by myself to meet up with friends, and I'll ever be indebted to those people who were powerful women in my life, who helped me get right with myself and helped me figure out who I was. And as I realized, I had really nothing to give until I knew who the heck I was. And through God, through that understanding, cultivation of a God of my understanding, realizing that inside me is that little feeling that tells you yeah or no, don't do it, that pain that I feel when I'm doing the wrong thing, that's God. For me, that's my higher power. And until I really got that, I had nothing to give to somebody else in part of like a relationship. I knew the 12 steps, and I two-stepped for a long time. I did the first and the 12th pretty damn well. But I did not clean out the inventory, and I didn't go and make the amends. And I did a horrible, horrible 10th step. And most of all, I failed in the 11th. And I didn't find. When I went there, though, and I started off by doing stuff that I couldn't even do for myself. Someone suggested, go out and actually try and have a relationship with a man. I'm not gay, and I don't say it like that, and I don't care if you are or whatnot. But for me, I've never had a relationship that lasts more than a year with anybody. I mean, like, my longest friend I think I have is probably about maybe 5 years. I've moved so many times. Like, I've just moved on. I'm always ever changing. I went out there and became a friend of somebody, of a male, and I understood what companionship and actually meant, giving to a relationship instead of taking. I then moved on to, I graduated to, well, what do you call them? Married women. You know, because I knew in my moral fiber I wouldn't go after that. And I understood what it was like to actually have a conversation with a woman and not see what I could get from it. And to me, that was one of the most powerful things I ever did, to have friends who were women and not have any motives. And to get, and for me, that was just where I was. And I became very comfortable with myself. I became very happy, even obstinately, on who I was. And I remember my program picking up. And I remember just feeling that presence of God and being really, really happy. I remember going and reading a different Emmett Fox and different spiritual literature, because AA kind of just opened the floodgates to me. When I had that spiritual awakening again, like, things just, it was a deluge, you know, of just absolute information for me to go out and make my own way. You know, I went, and it's kind of hard, because one of the greatest gifts I have is not the trips, is not like developing the relationship with the girl, the car, the job, or whatever. One of the biggest things that I hold today is one of the greatest things that I've ever done is the ability to sit in my room on a Saturday night and not fret about calling somebody, not fret about what's everybody thinking about. You know, if I go in on Monday, are they going to be saying, "Dude, you're a loser for sitting there not doing anything with anybody"? The ability to just be by myself at night and to have that fear lifted from me, to have that rage lifted from me, to accept things as what they really are. I mean, for me, that, you know, today, that, you know, I've fallen by the sixth and the seventh, I continue to find actions that used to not be objectionable, I now find them objectionable. Realizing that I can't steal, I can't lie. I still lie at different points, but I don't lie like I used to. And, you know, it's progress, not perfection. But I realize when I'm doing the wrong thing, I'm feeling the pain. You know, I go through that, and that's what the 6th and 7th mean to me today. My amends, nothing really crazy. If you came here tonight, listen for a story that was really crazy, and out of this, like waking up in different countries, that's not my experience. I came, I drank, you know, life got really bad, and I came into Alcoholics Anonymous, and that's where I was hit with what real life could be. And it's just amazing today. You know, I went down to Fairfax, on Concord Pike down in Delaware to go speak at a meeting last night, because I was called on Sunday or on Saturday night at 11 o'clock saying, "Hey, could I come down?" You know, when Alcoholics Anonymous knocks at the door, I answer. That's just what I do. Whether or not, and some people don't understand that, and that's fine. But for me, I know that's what saves my bacon, because in my heart, I know what's true. You know, I can approach a situation within 5 seconds, I know what the right thing is to do. Now I need the courage to go and do it. And usually I find that through spiritual guidance. It's just what I do in the morning, is just asking God to make me a vessel for Him, to allow me to go and do those things. And I'll tell you what, it progressively gets better. It really does. You know, if you're hurting in here, there's plenty of hope in here. There's a lot of people in here that absolutely love their life. Ask them what they did. It's just as simple as that. You know, I don't know really how to say how simple it truly actually is for me today. Other than, you know, I wake up, I pray, and I go do the next right thing, and I continue to stay close with Alcoholics Anonymous, because to me, God is pretty connected with there. You know, I go and I make myself available when I need to, and I continue to seek Him. You know, it's not easy. There's definitely a lot of more places that I'd probably like to be. There's a lot more things that I'd like to do, and I'll tell you what, I definitely like to be unspiritual at different times. And you know, I still am. I still am. I still feel on a daily basis and pretty much every one of my affairs, you know. And, you know, the honesty and open-mindedness and willingness are the three things that kind of keep me there and help me balance me out today between my work life, between my personal life, between AA. You know, being honest with myself that, you know, I know what the right thing is to do. Open-minded that maybe I don't have all the solutions, but that somebody else may. And that willing to do the one that I know. And willing to go through with it and keep my feet moving. I can't. I'm starting to ramble now, but I just want to close with this. If you're hurting tonight, if you've been in the program for 12 years or you're just coming in tonight, I'm so glad you're here. You know, go and find somebody who has something you want that you may not understand now, but and just ask them what they did. Because I'll tell you what, that's exactly what I did, and I got what they got. Thanks.